So we are just a few days before Purim now, and I would like to begin by discussing a halachic aspect of Purim, and as we will see, it's a specific discussion, but it will reveal for us a certain aspect of the day, which is important for our appreciation of this special Chag of Purim. A central feature of the Chag is the difference, or the distinction, that is made between the different types of cities. There are the open cities and the walled cities. The Prozim, the open cities, they have Purim on the 14th, which this year will be Thursday. And the walled cities have Purim on the 15th of Adar, which this year is Friday. Begins on Friday, I'm not exactly sure when it will end, but hopefully sometime between Kabbalah Shabbos and Havdalah. The background to this distinction, which is unique really amongst the Chagim, we never find the different people in different places. Ab initio is part of the original Takana, will celebrate on different days. You can have someone from a walled city, all around him, it's Purim, and for him it's a normal day. He doesn't say Tafnun, but for some people that's also a normal day. And then vice versa on the morrow. So the background to this unique feature is really in the Megillah itself, because it discusses how Al-Kein HaYudim HaPrazim HaYoshvim Ba'arei HaPrazos. It's because of the extra day that was given in Shushan Abir, which was a walled city, as we discussed at length last week. Everyone fought on the 13th and rested on the 14th. In Shushan they had this extra day, and it's an extra part of the miracle. And therefore, in order to mark this element, cities which are like Shushan rest on the 15th as they did in Shushan. Now, what does it mean to be like Shushan? The distinguishing feature became, the characteristic became the wool, perhaps because the wool represents the defenses, represents the strength of the place, and nonetheless, there were no casualties amongst the Jewish people, and their enemies were vanquished. And that's Tokef Hanes. And therefore, any city which is walled like Shushan reads like Shushan. Zecher to that aspect of the Nes. We may ask, however, presumably if we take our cue from Shushan, then when is the defining time, the time stamp of the wall presumably should be like Shushan? If you had a wall at the time of Shushan, then you read on the 15th. If not, then not. Yet as we know, the time is not from Shushan, but Irim Bukepes Oma Mimos Yehoshua Ben Nun, which is much earlier. Shushan itself did not have a wall, as far as we know, at the time of Yehoshua Ben Nun. Obviously, it's an exception. But the question is asked, why is it that the relevant time becomes the days of Yehoshua Ben Nun? And there are a number of answers, but a very beautiful answer, and important for us, is from the Yerushalmi. And that is Mishim Kavoda Shel Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim itself was lying in ruins. It had no wall. Everything was destroyed at the time that the Purim story took place. And therefore, you'd have a terrible situation whereby we celebrate those cities that have a wall, and Yerushalayim would be along with the other open cities, and that's considered to be incorrect. Therefore, the time is pulled back to the days of Yehoshua ben Nun, and therefore Yerushalayim reads, and so do all those other cities which had a wall from that time. And now, so far, everything is very clear-cut. You have your walled cities, your unwalled cities, from Yehoshua ben Nun, not from Yehoshua ben Nun, and everything should be nice and clear. The question is, what happens if we encounter a city where we're not sure whether it is in the category of walled from the time of Yehoshua ben Nun? Perhaps it has a wall, but we don't know when the wall is from. When do they read? 14th, 15th. Now, we find a precedent for this question in the Gemara in Maseches Megillah. Actually, the famous case is not exactly about this question, slightly related question. With regards to the city of Tveria. Now, Tveria is mentioned in the Tanakh at the time of Yehoshua ben Nun, in Sefer Yehoshua, it's called Chemes, I believe. And therefore, these are Arim Bitsuras, these are walled cities. So why is there a question mark about Tveria? Because Tveria was walled on three sides. On the fourth side was the sea, was the Kinneret. They didn't need a wall. So now the question is, does the sea on the fourth side of Tveria constitute the equivalent of a wall for Purim, which would make it the category of Mukepes Choma, or not? Is it about protection? It does afford a certain amount of protection. Is it about concealment? They're hardly concealed. So this is a question, and it's, in as far as the Gemara is concerned, Talmud Bavli, that is to say, it's unresolved. The Gemara tells us that Chizkiah, one of the rabbis of the Gemara, he read in Tveria on both days, on the 14th and the 15th. The Gemara tells us similarly about some called Rabbi Yamin, who read in a place called Hutzal. There's a shaila where that is, but it was also had this question as to whether it was walled from the time of Yeshua ben Nun, and he read on both days. So what we find in the Gemara so far is, when in doubt, anyone who's on record as acting here read on the 14th and the 15th. But now the question is, what's halacha? Kedas mala asos. And as we'll see, it's a question that's nogea to many, many communities. Well, the first to speak here are the Gaonim. The Gaonim, who are referenced in the Ramban, and the Ramban in their commentaries on Maseches Megillah, they state, very simply, we are aware of two categories of mitzvahs, D'oraisa and Rabbanan, from the Torah and from the rabbis. What do we do in situations of doubt? The rule of thumb is very clear. Safek D'oraisa, if it's a matter of doubt with regards to a Torah matter, L'chumra. We rule stringently. Both possibilities. Safek d'Rabbanan. Lukula, the doubt is with regards to Rabbanan, one can be lenient. And therefore, say the Gaonim, Megillah is many things, but it's not d'Oraisa. And therefore, in keeping with the principle of Safek d'Rabbanan Lukula, one doesn't need to read certainly on both days. One has to read on one of the days, because if you went through both days thinking maybe this is not the day, you'll end up definitely having missed the mitzvah, and that's not called Safek d'Rabbanan, but one certainly only needs to read on one of the days. In principle, one could choose, however, the recommendation is to read on the 14th, firstly, because that's the first opportunity you have, and secondly, most cities really read on the 14th, and therefore one would default back to the 14th. And this is the psak of the Gaonim. All of these cities that are in doubt, that they have a wall from the time of Yeshua ben Nun, they read on the 14th, and that's it. On the 15th, they're like every other city. It's Motzei Purim for them. The question is, what about all of those authorities in the Gemara? What about Chizkiah? He read on both days, and Rabbi Yamin read on both days. What are we to make of that? Says the Ran, Chizkiah and Rabbi Yamin were acting apimidas chasidus. They were machmir, and they were going beyond the letter of the law, and that's perfectly fine. However, the halacha is that one only needs to read on the 14th. So this is the position of the Gaonim, nice and clear. The Rambam, in Hilchos Megillah, in Perek Aleph, halacha Yud Aleph, writes as follows. Ir shehu safek, a city where there's a doubt. Ve'edua im haisu mukepes choma bimos Yeshua ben Nun. O achaka chukva. We're not sure. Was there a wall around it from the time of Yeshua? Perhaps there's a wall, but maybe that came afterwards. Kurin b'shnei hayomim. So these cities, they read both days. Shein yudalad v'tesvav uvelelehem. 14th, 15th, and the 9th, which is a total of four readings. But the bracha is only on the 14th. Okay. So with regards to the reading, Rambam rules that the Megillah is to be read on both days. And clearly he understands that when the Gemara tells us that Chizkiah read on both days and Rabbi Yamin read on both days, that's to tell us the halacha. They were acting lefi shuras hadin. That's what one needs to do. The question, of course, is why, after all? Whatever happened to our principle, our rule of thumb, if it's a suffix with regards to a Torah matter, one will stringently, but the Megillah is not the Oraisa. Why does the Rambam say one needs to read on both days? And the Turei Even, in his commentary on Masechet Megillah, explains, we're aware of two categories, the Oraisa, from the Torah, and Rabbanon, from the Rabbis. However, there is a third category, and it's kind of in between. And that category is called Divrei Nevi'im, or actually, in the words of the Gemara, Divrei Kabbalah. Whenever the Gemara refers to things that are written in the Nevi'im, perhaps Ksuvim as well, it refers to it as Divrei Kabbalah. Now, what is the status of these mitzvahs that are to be found in the Tanakh, not in the Taf of the Tanakh, in the Nun and Kaf of the Tanakh, in the Nevi'im and Ksuvim? On the one hand, they're not the Oraisa, they're not of the 613 mitzvahs, but on the other hand, they are not pure Derabanan. They're not exactly like the level of what we call Divrei Sofrim. They're less stringent than Divrei Torah, but more stringent than Derabanans. And sometimes they catch one of the halachic positions. The nafgemina for our situation is, when it comes to a suffik, not only suffik d'oraisa goes l'chumra, but also suffik divrei nevi'im goes l'chumra. The Rabbanon gave to them that status, that higher status of being machmir in the case of suffik, unlike what one would do in a quote-unquote pure d'Rabbanon, which has no reference in Tanakh at all. And this, says the Avnei Nezer, is the basis of the ruling of the Rambam. After all, the mitzvahs of Megillah are in the Megillah, which is part of Tanakh, and therefore they have the status of Divrei Kabbalah, Divrei Nevi'im, and in matters of doubt, one goes l'chumra. Now, interestingly, this understanding of the Rambam's position is shared by others, and according to the Rogachev Gaon, the Rambam himself states this explicitly. For these are the words of the Rambam, his opening words to Hilchas Megillah, Perek Aleph, Halacha Aleph. Says Rambam, Kriyas HaMegillah Bizmana, reading the Megillah in its time, Mitzvahs Asei Midivrei Sofrim. It's a positive mitzvah from the rabbis. And then, says Rambam, V'hadvarim yiduim shehitakonas ha-Nevi'im. And it's well known that it's an institution of the Nevi'im. And then the Rambam goes on to give all of the halachas. The question is, having introduced this mitzvah as Divrei Sofrim, why does the Rambam continue or proceed to tell us that it is well known that it's a takona of the Nevi'im? The Rambam's Mishnah Torah, says the Rogachover, it's not a historical work, it's a halachic work, which means by identifying Mikra Megillah as Takonas and Nevi'im, that's not just telling me as a matter of interest which of the Rabbanon instituted it, but rather it's a halachic statement, as if to say it's Midivrei Sofrim in the sense that it's not a Torah mitzvah, but it is not, quote-unquote, just Divrei Sofrim. It's Takonas and Nevi'im, which gives it added stringency, which will then express itself in any number of cases, one of which is our situation of those places which are in doubt which day they should read. The halacha is they read on both days. That's the position of the Rambam. And the Shulchan Aruch rules like the Rambam. As far as the Shulchan Aruch is concerned, these cities which are in Suffolk read both days. And in fact, the Shulchan Aruch himself lived in one of those places. Tzfat was a city that was considered to be one of those Sfakas. And in Tzfat, they read on both days. Now, we've understood so far, shall we say, half of the equation. Because we understand why the Rambam says to read both days as a matter of halacha. Divrei Nevi'im. Out of doubt. The question is, however, what about the bracha? We're mindful of the fact that the Rambam said they read on both days, but they only make the bracha on the first day. Now, from a certain point of view, making a bracha on the first day is more problematic than reading both days, Because if it's actually a question of doubt, so when in doubt, you can read both times. But what is our policy when it comes to brachas? If you're not sure which is the right day, and therefore suffer brachas, we say lahokel. If ever we're in doubt whether to perform a mitzvah, even if you perform the mitzvah michumra, but it's not with a bracha, that's our policy, that's certainly the Rambam's policy. Therefore, why do you make a bracha at all? The situation should look like read both days out of doubt, but don't make a bracha any day out of the same doubt. Maybe it's not the right day. So the Vilna Gaon explains that the position of the Rambam is based on a very interesting halacha, which is mentioned in the Yerushalmi. And that is, the truth of the matter is, that although these 2 days are separate, that is to say, for the open cities, 14th, for the walled cities, 15th, and never the twain shall meet, which means that if someone from the an open city would read the Haggad, would read the Megillah on the 15th, it's too late. But if someone from a walled city read the Megillah on the 14th, he's been Yotzei. So says the Yerushalmi. B'di'eved, anyone is Yotzei on the 14th. Even someone from a walled city, in a walled city, reading on the 14th, is Yotzei b'di'eved. It's not the right time, but he's Yotzei b'di'eved. And that being the case, says the Gaon, the Rambam has no problem with these places who read on both days. There's no problem making a bracha on the 14th, because actually there is no doubt that you're Yotzei the mitzvah. If you should be reading today, you're reading today. And even if you should be reading tomorrow, you're Yotzei if you read today, according to the Yerushalmi. And the Vilna Gaon understands that the Rambam accepts the ruling of the Yerushalmi, which is another way of saying that the Talmud Bavli does not dispute this. And that's why you can't lose if you read the Megillah on the 14th, and you certainly fulfill the mitzvah, and therefore you can certainly make the bracha. But that actually begets another question. If it's true, which is the final question of this psak of the Rambam, if it's true that b'di'eved, even for a definite walled city, you've definitely fulfilled the mitzvah if you read on the 14th, then these cities who are reading on the 14th out of doubt, why should they read again on the 15th? What will we say? Well, maybe they're walled cities. Well, maybe, but even if they are walled cities, they're still Yotzei if they read on the 14th, according to the Yerushalmi. So in the Sefer Kuntres B'inyanei Chanukah Megillah, which is written by a great Talmud Chacham, his name is Rav Chaim Aaron Turchin, he explains that although you are Yotzei the mitzvah, even in a walled city on the 14th, nonetheless, there exists a concept beyond the idea of a mitzvah. There is a concept called mitzvah bizmana. Sometimes one fulfills the mitzvah, but if it's not exactly in the right time, so b'di'eved, you did the mitzvah. But there's an added value in fulfilling the mitzvah in its right time. And therefore, as much as the mitzvah was fulfilled on the 14th, seeing as it's possible that the mitzvah, really, the Megillah really needs to be read on the 15th, therefore, they go back to read the Megillah again to fulfill the mitzvah bizman. Okay, so this is a survey of the reading of the Megillah. Reading both days, bracha on the first day. Now, thus far, with regards to reading a Megillah, which seems to catch most of everyone's attention, but as we know, there's plenty other mitzvahs when it comes to Purim. There's Mishloach Manos, Matanis Lev Yonim, Mishdev Simcha, the special laning for Purim, there's Al Hanisim that we say on Purim. What about all of those things? So these become now the sub-discussions of this question. The consensus amongst the Poskim is that if it's something that one can only gain from, so certainly one should do both days, which means, says the Mogen Avraham, quoting Rishonim, Mishloach Manos, Amatanes Lev Yonim, and Mishdev Simcha, Sudas Purim. So they should happen on both days for the very same reason. The feeling is one can hardly lose, right? What could possibly go wrong? Although with some Purim Sudas, that may be a case of famous last words. But nonetheless, the ruling is to have all of those things on both days. The two more, shall we say, problematic areas are the laning and the al-hanisim. You can't say what can you lose. We don't tend to take out the Sefer Torah for no good reason or for no definite reason, perhaps. To say al-hanisim, if it's not the time, is possibly a hefsek within benching or within davening. And therefore, although there were different places that had different minhagim, it's difficult to give a homogenous sweep of that every single community did the same thing. In some places they read on the second day, and in some places they said al-hanisim on the second day. But nonetheless, what seems the minhag as it seems to have settled in these communities is that they don't lay Yavo Amalek on the 15th, only on the 14th, and they don't say al-hanisim also on the 15th, only on the 14th. Now this is a question that is halacha lemaisa for a number of cities here in Eretz Yisrael. There are certain cities that we have back to antiquity. There are certain cities that are mentioned as being cities, walled cities, in the time of Yeshua ben Nun. Yafo is mentioned in Sefer Yeshua. Akko is mentioned in Sefer Shoftim, which is not long after Sefer Yeshua. And the city of Lod, actually, is mentioned in the Gemara in Maseches Megillah, is identified explicitly as having a wall from the time of Yeshua ben Nun. There are other places that we don't know, maybe yes, maybe no. But nonetheless, even with regards to these cities, it is not considered a matter of definacy to read on the 15th. And the reason very simply is that it's difficult to be certain that where these cities are now is exactly where they were at the time. We assume that they're in the general area, and we hope that they're quite close, but very difficult to look back and see this is exactly where the city of whatever it is, Yafo or Akko or Lud. And for that reason, they can't be treated as more than Safek, but nonetheless, because of Safek, they read, as we said, on the 14th with a bracha, on the 15th without a bracha, and the other mitzvahs they perform with both. Most of the places that fall under this shaila are in Eretz Yisrael. Are there any places in Chutz La'aretz where there's a suffix? Are they mukav chomer from the time of Yeshua ben Nun? Well, interestingly, there are. There were certain kehillas that were noheg purim on both days, as we've described. The Ben Ish Chai in Parshas Tetzaveh, who lived in Baghdad, says that the minhag in Baghdad was to have Purim on both days. They had a tradition that city was Mukav Choma from the time of Yeshua. The Sefer Kaf HaChaim mentions that the city of Damascus in Syria also had a Kabbalah, that they were Mukav Choma. Thus far more in the Arabian lands, but even in Europe, the Chai Adam in Simin Kufnun Hei, Klal Kufnun Hei, quotes the Masorah, that there were kehillas or communities in Prague who kept Purim on both days. They had a Masorah about Prague, that it went way back when, possibly to the time of Yeshua ben Nun, and they read the Megillah on both days. So far we have, and there are one or two others, there are various Sfarim that refer to the community of Izmir and Istanbul and Damascus and Baghdad. I'm not sure how many of the above mentioned communities one would recommend visiting on either day of Purim now. But nonetheless, this is through the Hishtalshilas Hadoros. Most of the communities under question are in Eretz Yisrael, but some of them yet even in Chutz La'aretz. So this is a very interesting shaila, as we said, for some halacha lemaisa. But the yesod that comes out, which is fascinating for us, is this idea, which according to the Turi Evans and the Rogatra of Agon is the Rambam's position, that Mikra, Megillah, and the mitzvahs of Purim are in the category of Divrei Kabbalah, of Divrei Nevi'im, which, shall we say, is either Midrabbanon plus or Midaraisa minus, somewhere in the middle. That's important for our appreciation. So from the halachic discussion, let us come now to consider some ideas with regard to Purim itself. The Vilna Gaon, in his Perush on Megillas Esther, notes that we glean a lot of insight when we consider Purim by comparing it with its sister Chag of Chanukah. Both of them, at least as a general category, they are Midrabbanan, post-Araisa, for sure. When we consider the miracles in both of these Chagim, says the Gaon, we'll conclude that the miracle of Chanukah was greater It was a higher octane miracle than that of Purim. In Purim, it was shtadlonos, the right people in the right place at the right time, and it was very mulubash, certainly b'derech hateva, when it comes to, it's a miracle nonetheless, but it seems to be a rather low-level miracle, shall we say, if we could term it that way. Hanukkah, on the other hand, even the quote-unquote natural miracle, was undeniably the rabbin biyad ma'atim, these few Hashmonai rebels against the Syrian army. And then, of course, in addition to that, you have this open miracle of the oil. So on every, it ticks every box with heavy black ink in terms of what we'd expect from a miracle, so to speak. Purim, it seems, less so. And yet, Purim as a chag, although it's shorter, is more of a chag than Hanukkah. If the defining characteristic of a chag is the idea of simcha and mishte, v'samachta v'chagecha, that concept of simcha and mishte accrues to Purim. It's one of the central aspects of the day. Hanukkah, less so. There's a famous Rama who says that it's not even clear that the mesibos and the sudas that people make on Hanukkah, they're almost not purely sudas mitzvah. One has to almost upgrade them to become sudas mitzvah. Say divrei Torah, and then they'll become sudas mitzvah. But it seems to be less of a yontif. Why would that be? Why does a greater miracle end up or generate a lesser yontif, and the lesser miracle generate a greater yontif? And the Vilna Gaon says that to appreciate the answer to this question, we need to understand that even miracles, even the channels of divine influence and providence, they also have their nature. They also have their setup. Eretz Yisrael is naturally a place where there is more hashgacha than in Chutz La'aretz, as the pasuk says in Parshas Ekev, Eine Eretz Asher, Eine Hashem Lekecha Bo, Mereshis Hashana, but Achar Hashana, Hashem, his eyes are on Eretz Yisrael. Certainly, when the Beis HaMikdash is standing, the Beis HaMikdash is called Shar HaShamayim, it's the gateway of heaven. That means it is the channel through which Hashpa'ah, divine providence, flows through to Eretz Yisrael first and foremost. And therefore, says the Vilna Gaon, a major statement, the miracle of Hanukkah was greater, but it's, so to speak, a lesser deal to have a great miracle. Because the miracle of Hanukkah took place in Eretz Yisrael, when the Beis HaMikdash is standing. There is higher expectation and natural infrastructure for that type of interaction. Contrast that with Purim. Off location, outside of Israel, there is no Hamikdash, there's zero expectation for any type of miracle. In fact, the Yalkut Shimoni in Megillas Esther presents this as part of the original conversation between Haman and Achashverosh. Haman comes to Achashverosh and suggests they should try and annihilate the Jewish people. Achashverosh refused, or he objected. He said they have a long history of people who tried exactly this, and they all failed, or almost all of them failed. I don't want to add my name to that list. It's not worth it. It's too high risk. And Haman responded, said the Medrash, that's different. They were in their land, they had their temple, so their God came through for them. But here they're not in their land, the temple's been destroyed. Don't worry, there's no precedent for this sort of thing. You'll be fine. Ad kedei kach, Haman understood that the climate was different. And nonetheless, HaKadosh Baruch Hu supervised and came through and protected and saved the Jewish people. Was it as great or prominent a miracle as Hanukkah? No. But it's a much more significant event, any type of miracle, than whatever happened in Hanukkah, because it was contrary to any type of expectation given the circumstances. And in a sense, the teaching of the miracle of Purim for all generations is that ultimately and fundamentally there is no location for there is no barrier of location when it comes to HaKadosh Baruch Hu's protection of the Jewish people. And this is a very delicate message, because on the one hand, the Hashgacha in Eretz Yisrael is immeasurably enhanced. It's a different level altogether, but it's the difference between yes and more. It's not the difference between yes and no. And that's the major lesson that comes now into the consciousness of the Jewish people, as indeed the Pasuk states, it's one of the famous psichos to Maseches Megillah that were given in the Gemara, to quote the Pasuk, Kashem Elokeinu b'chol kareinu elav, wherever we call out to Hashem, wherever it will be. Even if it's in Chutz La'aretz, fundamentally the connection is there and Hashem's protection is there. That's the first major chiddush of Purim. Hashem's relationship with the Jewish people extends to every place. Interestingly, the Gaon notes a similar chiddush, a similar phenomenon that resulted in a parallel breakthrough here. The Gemara in Chagiga, in the second perek, has a very interesting comparison and contrast between two nevuas, the nevuah of Yeshaya and the nevuah of Yechezkel. When it comes to the nevuah of Yechezkel, as we know, Perek Aleph, he describes what's called the Maaseh Merkava, the apparition and the experience of nevuah over something like 40 psukim. What were the Afanim like, and what were these Keruvim like, and it keeps on going. It's the Maaseh Merkava. And finally, he gets to what the message is at the end of the chapter. Yeshaya, in Perek Vav, his first nevuah, he says, Bishnas, whatever it is, Va'eres Hashem Yoshev al Kisei Ram v'Nisa, and this is what he said, essentially. So how is it, says the Gemara, why is it that Yechezkel describes everything, and Yeshaya describes very little? I mean, did they see something different? So the Gemara says, if you wish to understand, it's an amazing presentation. The Gemara says the difference between them, consider the difference between a villager and a city dweller. Yechezkel is like Doma Leben Kfar. He's like a villager. Yeshaya is Doma Leben Krach. He's like the city dweller. Now what's that mean? What's the difference between the city dweller? How does it help us? So Rashi explains that if someone lives in a city, so they're used to city life. They're used to all of the appurtenances and all of the features of, especially if it's the capital city. Now, they may see the king. Okay? How will they describe it? They'll say they saw the king. Imagine a villager who, he's never seen anything like this before. He's transported from the backwaters of whatever. So when he describes what he saw, he'll begin with the traffic lights and the neon signs and the tall buildings and the cars and the whole thing. Well, there's no stopping him. He's completely overwhelmed and he'll spare you no detail. And finally, hopefully, he won't forget to tell you that he saw the king as well and what it is that he said. And this similarly says Rashi, Yeshaya lives in Yerushalayim. It's the metropolis. It's the capital city of Nevuah. So he has his Nevuah, but he's familiar with at least the background, and he very quickly gets to the point of the content of the Nevuah. Yechezkel's Nevuah takes place on the Euphrates River. Chutz La'aretz, he's in the village. For him to have a nevuah, he's overwhelmed by everything, and he describes everything in a blow-by-blow detail. That's how Rashi explains. Interestingly, Tosfos, and this is the approach that's adopted by the Vilna Gaon, explains somewhat differently. See, Rashi has explained the difference between Yeshaya as city dweller and Yechezkel as villager is the difference between the city dweller, sees the king in the city, or the villager who makes his way somehow to the city and sees the king. But the Tosas explain that the intent of the Gemara is the difference between a city dweller who sees the king, who says he saw the king in the city, and a villager who says that he saw the king in the village. That means one morning he gets up and he says, last night when everyone was sleeping, you know what happened? The king came. Now the king doesn't visit the village. Which means the first question that people will ask is, well, what did he look like? And why? Because no one will believe that the king would visit the village. So they'll want him to verify. How's he going to verify? No. If so, imkeinim hadvarim, tell us what he looked like. Okay? So he describes everything in such detail in order to verify his story. He'll start talking about what the chariot looked like and this and that. By the time he's finished, those who know what this is meant to look like, who had nevuah, they'll say, what do you know? I guess he really did visit the village. So it's a very different angle in terms of what's behind Yechezkel describing all of these things. And the point is that the Chiddush of Nevuah, therefore, and the Gemara discusses this in Maseches Moed Katan and Daf Kaf Hey, how could it be that Yechezkel had Nevuah in Chutz La'aretz? He already had Nevuah in Eretz Yisrael, that helped, and he'd already established the connection, so to speak, but it followed him out to Chutz La'aretz, and no one was expecting it. If you would tell people, Nevuah b'Chutz La'aretz, al ta'amin. Until Yechezkel says, no, he really had Nevuah, and it was it. No one, they couldn't get over it, and no one believed him. Until 40 psukim later, people said, what do you know? I guess there really is Nevuah in Chutz La'aretz. Followed them out because they needed it. Network coverage, so to speak, for Nevuah does not naturally extend to Chutz La'aretz. But if necessary, those boundaries are suspended. And this is the parallel chiddush of Hashem's influence as miracle for the Jewish people and as Nevuah as a message for the prophets of the Jewish people. Libi Omeli. I have a certain feeling that this may explain to us a unique phenomenon when it comes to Purim. We've spoken about different days for the different places, walled cities 15th, unwalled cities 14th. There are other days, in principle, that the Megillah can be read. It's fallen into disuse for reasons that the Gemara describes, but it's the very opening Mishnah of Maseches Megillah. Megillah can be read in principle on the 11th of Adar, the 12th, and the 13th. 14th and 15th, of course. How can it be read from the 11th to the 13th? That's not Purim by anyone's definition. Says the Gemara, Hakfarim, the villagers, Makdim Eliyom HaKnisa. What's the background? Villagers, they lived in the outlying places. They visited the town, typically the city, on Mondays and Thursdays. That was Beis Din Day, Laning Day, Market Day, what have you. And therefore, that's when they would make their way into the city. Other than that, you won't find them. And therefore, there was a dispensation. It's based on Psukim in the Megillah itself. There's dispensation to the villagers that whatever day Purim falls, if it's not a Monday or Thursday, they can bring the reading back to the preceding Monday or Thursday. Which means if the 14th of Adar falls on Tuesday, they're not going to be in the city on Tuesday. And they can't read by themselves. No one can read in the village. So they can read it the day before, the preceding Monday. And if it's Wednesday, 2 days before. And if it's Sunday, 3 days before. They can pull it back to the preceding Thursday. That's the 11th of Adar. Amazing. Never do we find a concept like this. You're in the village, and it's not in the city, and you can read on the preceding, when it's going to be in the city. Imagine, when's Rosh Hashanah? This Monday. I'm not going to be in the city on Monday. Sunday works well for me. But Monday's not going to go. But I'm free all Sunday. Morning's actually better. What type of conversation is that? We're meant to be having a religion here. Which means that whenever that's the day, that's the day. And if you don't have business in the city, make it your business to be in the city. Once a year comes a festival called Purim. And it falls on Tuesday. And the people in the village were there on Monday. And it's hard for them. I should come in again. Yes, it's Purim. And the halacha said no. Anshei Knesset HaGadola said no. It's hard for you? Okay, we'll work it out. You're there on Monday? You can read on Monday. It's okay. How did it become okay? This has no ach vareya in any other chag. Where does this takana for the villagers come from? So of course, halachically it comes from the Megillah, but I have a feeling that the reason why this takana exists for the villagers who couldn't otherwise make it to the city is because the entire story of Purim is about villagers who couldn't otherwise make it to the city. Chutz La'aretz is the village, as we saw from Yechezkel and Yeshaya, as compared to Yerushalayim. And therefore, if HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so to speak, was so strict about this is what's happening in the city, and if you're in the village and you can't make it to the city, well, that's just too bad. Then there would be no Purim story. There would be no salvation of the Jewish people. What is the whole concept of Purim? That HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, I'm in the city, you're in the village, difficult, we'll work it out. We'll come to meet each other. We'll make a connection. And therefore, within the halacha, the city says to the villagers every year, you're in the village, difficult for you to come to the city, we'll work it out. We'll see when you are in the city, we'll make an arrangement and that's you fulfill the mitzvah. That's got the miracle of Purim written all over it. There is a further chiddush, a further realization really when it comes to Purim. And that is that we'd never been thrown out of Israel before. We'd never been exiled in having become Hashem's nation and entered into Eretz Yisrael. This was our first exile. And to appreciate that our relationship with Hashem, so to speak, or in principle, is based on a covenant, it's based on a covenant which we violated, and with us thrown out, and the expectation in terms of the relationship is we had it, we lost it, and it's gone. Since when does one party go after the other party, even when that's the one that violated the relationship? That's when relationships end. And Hashem came after us. We thought he's finished with us. And it's our fault. And Hashem said, it is your fault, but we're not finished. We'll never be finished. Which means that the Eretz Yisrael, Chutz La'aretz, revealed to us that Hashem's relationship with us is in every place. And the pre-breakage of the covenant, post-breakage, revealed to us that Hashem will always be with us in every time. Even when we think that our relationship is finished because we don't deserve to be his people anymore, it's not finished. That's Netzach Yisrael. You know, in the morning before Kriyat Shema, there's a bracha preceding Shema in the morning and the evening. In the morning it's Ava Rabbah, and in the evening it's Avas Olam. And the difference between them, that's the Minhag Ashkenaz, and the difference between them is that Ava Rabbah is great love, Avas Olam is eternal love. And great love is appropriate for the morning. The morning is when everything's good and clear and everything is as it should be, and then Hashem's love for us is abundant. In the evening, we don't have Ava Rabbah anymore. The Purim story took place in the evening, so to speak. We're in Golus, and it's dark, and we didn't have Ava Rabbah. But that's when we discovered Avas Olam, that Hashem's love for us is always there. And once we realized that, it changed our expectations from that point onwards. That's why we say, with regards to Purim, Teshuasa Ma'isa L'Netzach, that is an eternal Teshua, because it represents the eternity of the Jewish people. V'tikvasam b'chol dor v'dor. That gives hope for each and every generation. There are generations who may have thought, well, it's over. But that's what the original generation thought. But they were wrong. Purim revealed to them that it's never over. That's hope for all the ensuing generations. Tikvasam b'chol dor v'dor. Now, related to this, as we know, it's based on the statement of the Tikkuni Zohar. There exists a relationship of sorts between Yom Kippur and Purim. Purim is either called after Yom Kippurim, or Yom Kippurim is Yom Kippurim, which is as the Arizal formulated it later on. However you formulate it, each one is as difficult to understand as the other. It's one of the least intuitive connections one could make, the words aside, of connecting Yom Kippur like Purim. They couldn't be more different, certainly in terms of the way we conduct ourselves. No one, if they'd never seen the statement before, no one would come to that conclusion, that the 2 days are connected. And the Zohar says, but they are. And there are many, obviously, many ways to explain how, but I'd like to explore one of them. A central aspect or theme within the story of Purim is that of decisions and considerations. Why people do the things that they do. Do they do things that make sense to them? Do they do things that don't make sense to them? And how do those work out for them? We've already seen this last week in our discussion of the second parak of Megillas Esther, whereby Esther at a certain point, although in the beginning, it makes perfect sense. to Esther and to all of us that she shouldn't say where she's from. She was caught running away. It's dangerous. That's not the time to be found out to be Jewish. And so she didn't say. But 10 psukim later, and it sounds like the climate is yes, right, to say that she's Jewish. She's safe and it's good. It could even be a benefit to her people. And the pasuk says, nothing doing. Ein Esther magedes melal tavesama kasher tziva aleha Mordechai. She hasn't had the yes from Mordechai. She's not saying. What is Esther thinking? We may ask, says the Vilna Gaon. What is Esther thinking at that time? Does she understand why it is that she shouldn't say? It sounds like she should already say where she's from. Mordechai says no, and that's what she follows. Contrary to her intuition. Who could have known at that time why that would be important and how there would be a more opportune time, infinitely more so, later on. But it goes further. Because the final psukim of Perek Beis, which we discussed last week, are the plot of Dikson and Teresh. And we know the story so well, we failed to ask, perhaps, the most basic question. They're plotting to assassinate the king, and Mordechai finds out about it, so naturally he tells Esther, and naturally he tells Achashverosh, and then he dispenses justice with them, or whatever. And that's how the perek ends, and it's all good. Says Vilna Gaon, will someone please explain why that was considered to be appropriate to tell Achashverosh that they're going to kill him? Esther is currently being held against her will as Achashverosh's wife. What happens if you expose the plot? They could kill him. And if they kill him, Esther's free. And no one has to know that Mordechai knew. Shevval taseh. All your problems will be taken care of. Malachta nasa zayidei acherim. Achashverosh will be killed. It's nothing he didn't do to countless others. And then Esther will be free. We're so used to it's the natural flow of information. You found out about it. Obviously, the Achashverosh. You obviously should not tell Achashverosh. And hopefully he'll die. And Esther could come back and be Jewish again. Or be in a Jewish environment again. But Mordechai says, tell Achashverosh. What a moment. Esther goes to tell Achashverosh. She is basically orchestrating the perpetuation of her marriage to Achashverosh. One can only imagine Achashverosh's reaction. When he kills Bigtan and Teresh, he says to Esther, I'm so happy you told me. If you hadn't told me, they could have killed me, and then you would have been all alone. We consider that to be a good scenario. And Mordechai says, tell Achashverosh. Who can fathom such things? Who can relate to that as being the correct course of action? Mordechai said, Esther did. Whatever she may have thought was the good course of, correct course of action, was suspended. She follows Mordechai. And the truth is, ultimately, it broadens way beyond Esther. It's about the entire Jewish people. Rav Elia Lapian says, we believe we mentioned this in the past, the heroes, we call the heroes of the story of Esther, who are they? They're Mordechai and Esther. They are. But ultimately, the entire Jewish people are the heroes of the story of Esther. And the reason why is because everything they did to better their situation was on the advice, again, of Mordechai. Mordechai, as far as rational thought is concerned, is not their salvation. He is the problem. Life as they know it was relatively okay. There was no trouble. Who started the trouble? Mordechai. He's the one that agitated Haman. He's the one that made a point. He's the dafkanik. And everyone else is bent down, just as they should, and showing their acheres. Mordechai doesn't, and now they're in trouble. There is no question that the intuitive perception of Mordechai at that time was the cause of their troubles. And now, it's the hour of the knife. They have to decide, because they're in terrible trouble. Along comes Mordechai and says to them the unthinkable. I know it looks like I'm the problem, but I'm not. You're the problem, because 12 years ago you went to Achashverosh's feast. It's a long time ago, some of you. And almost 70 years ago, others of you bowed down to Nebuchadnezzar's statue, which means you are the problem and I'm the solution. And if you want to get out of your problem, you'll have to do exactly what I say. So this is a defining moment for the Jewish people. They either throw Mordechai to the lions and pursue their own course, maybe appease Haman that way, or they make a decision to follow Mordechai, contrary to everything that their seichel is telling them. And the Jewish people made this heroic decision, and they said, listen, it doesn't look to us that way. We didn't suffer anything from the, not from the party and not from bowing down to Nebuchadnezzar. You seem to be the problem, but you're Mordechai. You're the head of the Sanhedrin. We can't get this wrong. We're following you. That is the most heroic moment of this Purim story. And what are we to make of this theme? As we mentioned, the Gemara in Megillah told us that the Talmidim of Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai asked him, what did the Jewish people do to merit such a disastrous decree? So some suggested because they went to Achashverosh's feast, but that's only those in Shushan. What about the rest of the Jewish people? And Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai said it's because they bowed down to that statue of the Nebuchadnezzar all those years ago. That was the wrong thing to do. They should have done like Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, those three exceptions, and refused. So the Gemara says, well, if it was so terrible, then why were they spared? Where is justice? And Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai said, because even when they bowed down to the Nebuchadnezzar statue, they didn't mean it. They didn't think this is now their the master of the universe. Their heart was with Hashem. But they thought it would appease Nebuchadnezzar, and they made a strategic decision. But because they didn't mean it, an amazing parallel, so Hashem brings this decree against them, but in the end he didn't mean it, but they needed to confront it. But that teaches us that the Jewish people in this original time that got them into so much trouble, their heart is in the right place. Their heart's with Hashem, they're Jews. How will they get on in life? Perhaps to cut corners, perhaps to do something that's not so appropriate. They made a decision. It was a wrong decision. And that's why the way back ultimately for the Jewish people, beginning with Esther and ultimately the Jewish people, are to put them in a situation where they will need to make a decision. And it's not the politically correct decision. It's not the strategically intuitive decision. But it's got to be what, beyond their strategic faculties, they know in their heart of hearts to be right. And therefore Esther is put in a situation, she's told to do something that every fiber of her intellect is saying is the wrong idea. But it's that, following Mordechai, or following her own thoughts on the matter, this is the beginning of the way back. And so it is ultimately for the Jewish people. Where did the Jewish people get this capacity from? Where are they meant to draw their decisions from, if not their decision-making faculties, if not their intellect? It must be that these decisions are coming from a place that is higher or deeper than their intellect. Their das may be telling them, well, you'll get ahead in life like this or like this, and that's the right move. And Mordechai is calling on them, you've got to reach past that. You've got to reach into a part of you that knows exactly how it will succeed. And that can be counterintuitive sometimes. That's their essence. And the essence of the Jewish people is always connected to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Which means that Purim celebrates the eternity of the Jewish people. Tshuvas HaMeisel HaNetzach. But the eternity of the Jewish people, some consider it a mystery. Mark Twain famously concludes his paragraph that way. What is the secret of their eternity? Because he didn't learn Megillas Esther with Mefarshim. The secret of their eternity is their eternal connection to the eternal God. That's the secret of their eternity. As long as they give prominence to that, they're always connected. That's their godly connection, the eternal connection. Which means that on Purim, when we celebrate the eternity of the Jewish people, essentially, we are emphasizing and celebrating the aspect of the Jewish people that gives them that eternity. And that's their godly essence that's always connected to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And thus, when we come back to the unlikely connection, equation, between Yom Kippur and Purim, and how are they connected? They're actually dedicated to the same theme. They are looking, each one for its own purposes, to present and define the inner essence of the Jewish people. On Yom Kippur, it's for purposes of receiving kapara. The only way that we can rejuvenate and regenerate and recover from Averos is by giving primacy to the our inner essence, and that's where the Kohen Gadol on Yom Kippur goes, Lifnai v'lifnim, inside the inside, in order to tap into that aspect of the Jewish people. So too in Purim, where we are identifying that as the source of Chuvasa Ma'isa Netzach. And that brings us to one of the more colorful halachas of Purim, which is that of Chayev Inish Lebesume Bepuria, Adela Yada, Ben Arahama Lebaruch Mordechai. There's many, many gradations and variations, each to each their own. But what is happening, which is such an unusual halacha, to say the least, essentially, the Jew on Purim is being asked to part with a segment, some, if not all, again, depending on who you bask on like, of his das, of his cognitive faculties, of his intellectual, judicial faculties. Why? Because he's looking to access and to promote the aspect of the Jew that is higher than that, that is deeper than that. Because that's what saved the Jewish people at the time. Or to say this slightly differently, we say that Yom Kippur is like Purim. Yom Kippur is called Shabbos Shabbosim. Shabbos is a rest, and Shabbos Shabbosim is a super rest. That means that on Shabbos we refrain from creating, because Hashem created the world, and on Yom Kippur we refrain from more than creating. We refrain from eating and drinking. The Rambam refers to the fast as Shavisa Me'achila Ushtia, resting from eating and drinking. We rest from eating and drinking on Yom Kippur because that represents our engagement with the physical world, which is there for us to use for good purposes. The extent to which we may have mishandled it during the year requires that once a year we step back and we take a break. We take time out from being engaged in the physical world. And there's no eating and there's no drinking. And that's why it's a Shavisa. Another faculty that's given to us to be used for good purposes is our mind and our thoughts. And hopefully we use them for the most part for good things, but sometimes they can lead us astray, and sometimes we can get ahead of ourselves or to the wrong side of ourselves. On Yom Kippur, we rest from eating and drinking. On Purim, we don't rest from eating and drinking. But it's like Yom Kippur, because it's also a Shabbos Shabboson. We rest from thinking. It's a day where we put to rest the faculty of thought. For the same reason that we don't eat and drink on Yom Kippur, because we may have mishandled it, we may have abused it during the year. So we're looking to step back from it, take stock, express what it should be representing by giving primacy to the inner essence of the Jewish people, and the cognitive faculty should be serving that, and it's the heart of the Jewish people that takes over on Purim. And that should really set the tone as thoughts come back with whatever speed they do. On Motzei Purim, they come back, but the tone has been set. In a sense, the system has been rebooted, Belaz, whereby the mission statement of the Jewish people has been set by the heart on Purim, and then hopefully we can re-engage correctly with thoughts after Purim, as surely as we hope to re-engage with eating and drinking after Yom Kippurim. And so, in conclusion, it's very interesting to raise the question with regards to Purim. You know, certain Chagim, one could say, are very national in nature. Pesach is the birth of a nation. Others are very personal, one could say, in nature. Yom Kippur, I believe, is a Rosh Hashanah. These are, you know, personal times. What about Purim? Is it personal? Is it national? Is it about the Jewish nation, or is it about the Jew? And the answer, based on our discussion, which I believe is an important unifying answer, is yes. It's about both of them, but it can be about both of them because it's the same root that makes it about both of them. It's about the eternity of the Jewish people, the indestructible nature of the Jewish people because of their connection to Hashem. And it's about the individual Jew looking to live life as best he can based on his connection with Hashem. Can it be a day where a person has this dual focus, personal and national? I believe that the answer to that is in the Megillah itself. When Ahasuerus asks Esther, "What do you want?" Masha'ela seich, umabakasha seich. Esther responds, "Nafshi b'she'elosi, Ve'ami bebakashasi. I'm asking for my soul, and I'm seeking out for my people. And in a sense, that is the clarion call for Purim Ledoros. Whereas each person sits down to celebrate Purim, it's part of the Jewish people. It's in order to rejuvenate his own Jewishness, in order to hear again the sound of his own heart. Nafshi b'she'lasi, he's looking out for his soul. Ultimately, b'avim b'vakashasi. So I believe this perspective on Purim gives a great deal of insight and orientation. And in Mitzvah Hashem, this should be a time where we celebrate Shirasa Mitzvah Lenetzach, and it should be Tikvasam L'dor V'dor. Leave it over there.